This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. The Women's Fund of Greater Chattanooga is a nonprofit that works to improve the lives of women and girls in our area. Its new executive director is Erica Burnett, who comes here from Nashville. She plans to leverage her experience with advocacy, philanthropy, and building partnerships to address the root causes of inequity and create lasting change for women and girls. Erica, thanks for joining us.
I'm so glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
And welcome to Chattanooga.
Thank you. Everyone's been so warm and welcoming. Chattanooga's been one of my favorite cities to visit since I've been a transplant here in the South, and I'm looking forward to calling it home.
Now, you mentioned a transplant here in the South. I know that you are coming to us here in Chattanooga from Nashville. Tell us a little bit more.
Absolutely. So I'm a Midwest girl, born and raised between Detroit and Indianapolis. So my family is originally from South Bend, Indiana, where Notre Dame is located. That's our claim to fame. When my parents got married, we actually moved to Detroit. So I am very much a city girl. We relocated to Indianapolis to join the rest of my mother's family when I was a teen. And all of my adult life has been in Nashville, Tennessee, where I attended Tennessee State for undergrad and then Vanderbilt for my graduate studies.
Tell us more about the work that you have done in Nashville for many, many years that caught the attention of folks here in Chattanooga.
So I came to Tennessee pretty green, like most of us, especially thinking about spreading my wings. I was very young. I was actually 17 when I started college. And I've always had a passion for community. I say my first job was actually working as a volunteer teacher with the Children's Museum of Indianapolis. I was so excited when I turned 14 and I was able to volunteer at the Children's Museum, which was one of my favorite places to go and visit when I was a child. So when I would come and visit the city, my aunts and uncles, that was my favorite spot to go and visit. So when I became of age, the very first thing I wanted to do was be able to be in a space where I could share the joy and the learning that I experienced at the Children's Museum with other students. And I think that translated for me when I started to think about my career. So my undergrad major was actually English education. And like most of us who received teacher certification, I was able to commit my student teaching in our public schools here in Nashville. And at the time, which this would have been the early 2000s, Nashville had actually been identified as a youth violence hotspot nationally. So there were lots of not only federal dollars, but attention in the media and politically in thinking about how we could reduce the incidence of youth violence by really thinking about more of the root causes. That was really the launching point for my career. During my student teaching, I recognized for myself that being inside the classroom was not where I wanted to have an impact. I had one student in particular that I can recall who was shot during an altercation one weekend. Luckily, the damage was not life-threatening, but I just think about, I was able, that student allowed me an opportunity to really pause and think about what else was happening in his life, in his world, in the environment that would serve as a challenge for him to be able to come in my classroom and learn about Shakespeare, for instance. And really, that took on a life of its own. I pursued my master's degree in community development, specifically in thinking about what is the intersection between community-level disparities and the role of businesses and nonprofits in addressing some of those system levels issues and root causes. And so the unfolding of my career really was centered in how do we think about community issues, not just at the grassroots level, knowing that we have to provide direct services for individuals who are in need now, but then what are also those systems levels approach when we think about the intersection of different institutions, as well as policies and laws that will create the incubator for success for these populations who have been historically marginalized. So that took on a couple of different forms. I was a direct service provider with one of the largest youth service organizations here in Nashville. I was a grants manager thinking about trainings around domestic violence and interventions for law enforcement officers. And from there, had an opportunity to think more at the executive and leadership level of how are we positioning different organizations, both from a professional development perspective, but then also the on-the-ground tools that they need to be successful with populations, and where does collaboration exist within that entire field so that we're creating a more solid framework and safety net for the populations that we're advocating for and with. Most recently, I had the privilege of launching the Women's of Color Collaborative with a co-conspirator of mine, Nicole Kemp. She and I, our professional careers very much mirrored each other for about 10 or 12 years or so. And we got to the place where we recognized that there needed to be some intentional safe spaces for specifically for women and girls of color in this current environment as we are thinking about where our social services are still not supporting the populations that are most at risk and most vulnerable. And as we think about all of the data points across education, across our workforce development, we know that that sweet spot is really our women and girls of color in particular. So if we can make life better for them, then by default, our communities become better. And that really is my positioning and how I've approached the work that I do in community.
Where have things changed for the better in Nashville over the last 20 years? Where have things still stayed the same?
Well, I think Nashville is a reflection of what we see across Tennessee, as well as really across our country. And so the changes that I have witnessed over the last 17 or so years include much more diversity just in our general population. So for those of you who may not know, Nashville was considered a sanctuary city for a very long time. And so we saw an influx of immigrant and refugee populations, families, communities that started to settle here in the city, which provided a wonderful opportunity for us to think more creatively and innovatively about what are those resources that are necessary in order for these diverse populations to grow and thrive. So the first layer of intervention was more from a safety perspective. How do we think about our hierarchy of needs? How do we provide safe housing? How do we have access to education? How are we thinking about workforce engagement and development? And then sort of the next tier of engagement that I've seen transpire over the last, I would say maybe 10 or so years, is then thinking about policies that allow for equitable access, access to professional experiences, access to funding for when we're thinking about small businesses. Who's at the tables when policies are being made or referendums are being presented, for instance? Whose voices are being reflected when we're thinking about issues of transportation? One of the moments of contention here in the city most recently was around issues of transportation. So I think we've seen these hotspots, issues and policies, whether it's education, workforce development, or transportation, very specifically here in Nashville, take on a new voice where we're including the priorities of populations who not only have not been present, but have absolutely not had voices who even reflected their needs and their desires. And so what I've been really proud of the city, this city, and that I think is reflective of the needs across our state, is how we are including those voices farther upstream so that we're not just reacting to their needs from a place of a deficit, but that we can think about the assets that the diversity of thought and experience bring to the table early on when we're having the conversations on the front end.
How do you see the needs here in Chattanooga? How are they like what you have seen in Nashville? How are they different?
The first place that I've been able to identify some significant overlap is this understanding of pipelines for workforce development and also pipelines through our education system. So I've heard quite a few leaders in our community, in the Chattanooga community, as well as community members who are thinking about their needs, the needs of the populations that they serve, whether it's through a volunteer role or even within organizations that they're a part of or church homes, et cetera, is the future. Are we setting up Chattanooga for success when it comes to our students? Do they have the education necessary in order to make them competitive employers, potential employers and employees within the city? Are we able to attract and keep talent in a way that allows the city to continue to grow and thrive? And I think those are questions that most cities are wrestling with right now. We know that gentrification is real. There is a very real cycle of ebb and flow within city cores and pushing individuals out. When we recruit new businesses who are going to be at the center of and anchors in our communities from an economic perspective, what are those practices? What are those recruiting practices? What are the hiring practices? What are the professional development opportunities that are afforded within each of those entities and those institutions? And how does that play into the bigger picture of diversity within our city? If we are thinking about and looking at the cross-section of our population, does our workforce reflect that? And does our workforce reflect that at various income levels. I see those issues within Chattanooga the same as some, like for instance in Nashville, but it just feels different. There are different businesses, there's different history when it comes to individuals and populations that have been historically marginalized and or included at the table. I think what feels uniquely different about Chattanooga in my very little experience to date is the willingness to collaborate. One of the reasons that I attribute my success as a professional here in Nashville has been a willingness to sit at tables with folks who have a diversity of thought, whose lived experience looks very different than mine, and who maybe even entry points to understanding an issue may be from a very different perspective than my own. I have been greeted with such warm welcomes as well as an open invitation to think innovatively about what collaboration can look like. Where are those places that we can take a flashlight and shine a little into the cracks of the city so we can better understand what opportunities we have to bridge a gap? And so what I am uniquely looking forward to is the ways in which Chattanooga and all of its residents and the businesses and the nonprofits that I had a chance to meet with thus far are thinking about the intersection of all these issues. Yes, we all have very specific missions and we have to stay focused on that. We are uniquely positioned to do our work well, but we also need to know who we're playing in the sandbox with. And Chattanooga feels like it is primed to think about how we bridge some of those gaps in order to better serve the collective.
Tell me more about how these problems, these challenges, the type of collaboration that you were talking about, particularly impact and involve Black women and girls, a specific emphasis of your work.
Prior to our conversation, I had an opportunity to discuss these same issues with a member from the mayor's office. So an amazing, talented member of their staff who runs the fellowship program there that is specifically looking at creating economic pipelines for workforce development for individuals of color coming out of college and thinking about their early professional careers. So what we know to be true is that women of color are receiving degrees and are more highly educated, one, now than at any point in our history, but as a population have more degrees and are more highly educated than any other subpopulation in our country. That is absolutely a fact. And what we also know is that millennials overall are not staying in their places of employment for nearly the longevity that we see Gen Xers or baby boomers. Now, that is a very complicated issue. Some of that has to do with the culture of our workforce right now. It also has to do with the fact that many employers don't have the ability to provide upward mobility positions for this highly educated population. So if we think about where all of these problems intersect or these dynamics intersect, there is a proverb that talks about if you find a woman, and particularly a woman of color, a Black woman in this regard, that you can see the health of a community. And so if we just take this case study anecdotally, where you have individuals who are the most educated, right? But then we also know there's a historical implication around lack of resources. This is also the population that has the lowest wealth, individual wealth, household wealth of the majority of the subpopulations within our country, right? Then we see how there is a mixed matching of positioning, both from a historical and a current landscape perspective, and the capability and the capacity of this same group. Millennials are giving at a higher rate, even a higher rate than baby boomers to date. And so we think about then what is the role of philanthropy and how do we see our investment into a space? So all of these combined and with the shift in a political environment, knowing that Chattanooga is in a very interesting place right now where we're on the heels of a major election, knowing that there are going to be elected officials who will shift the trajectory of how we are prioritizing things in our city. Women and girls of color are not only most vulnerable given all the context that I just described, but they also are primed to be in a position to see the most change and the most progress and shift in their condition if we position ourselves successfully. And that is going to take collaboration. The reality is, when we talk about generational wealth and when we think about who has had power historically within various industries and across sectors, women and girls of color are at the bottom of the totem pole. And so my goal and the work of the Women's Fund, along with partnering with initiatives out of the mayor's office and thinking about amazing partners like Girls Eat, is to think about the full breadth of experience of women and girls of color and identify very specific strategies and campaigns that will help move the needle. How do we build pipelines for mentorship between the colleges and universities and important employers and pivotal industries within our community? How do we think about strategic positioning so that individuals are able to create that upper middle class, those levels of professionals that we see slowly fading away from our workplace environments, and thus we're not creating the pathways for those professionals that we want to stay in the city. And then we think about basic needs. We just did an amazing campaign with many of the other service providers in the city to provide period products for young girls, knowing that issues around hygiene, those issues that center the bodies of women and girls, are typically left off of legislative agendas. And oftentimes there are policies and practices even at our community level that don't allow for even the biology of a woman to be able to allow her to be successful in places. And so we not only have to think about that grassroots, what are the immediate needs of our girls and women right now? How do we bridge that gap for them? But then also, what are the pipelines that we're creating in order to build a more sustainable future for the city?
Where can people go online for more information and to connect with you and the fund?
You can find us on all the things at womensfundofgreaterchattanooga.org. That's our website. You can find us on Facebook as well as Twitter and Instagram with the same handle.
All right, Erica, thanks so much.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure speaking with you.
Yahoo Fest is Chattanooga's celebration of young adult literature. This year, it takes place online through Zoom starting Monday, September 14th through Thursday, September 17th. Joel Henderson, who chairs the Humanities Department at Chattanooga State Community College, is director of Yahoo Fest, and Linda Levan is executive director of Southern Lit Alliance. Joel, Linda, thanks for joining us.
Very happy to be here. Yeah, thanks for having us.
And it is a different festival this year for reasons that we all know too well. How are we going to hold the festival this year?
Well, Ray, we've decided to hold the festival as every other organization around the country is doing, virtually. We're excited to be offering a virtual festival through Zoom. It's the platform that's most familiar to the students in the area, and that is our target market. We are requiring pre-registration via Eventbrite in order to safeguard both our participants and our panelists, but we are going virtual this year. It's a change, but it's one we're excited about.
And is this drawing a different crop of authors than you would usually be able to bring in to Chattanooga?
Yes and no. So it's been really exciting in that we have the authors that we'd already arranged for an on-site festival have decided to brave this new virtual world with us, and they're sticking with us. But we're also bringing in some authors who we couldn't really afford to bring in otherwise. Ones from California and Chicago and places like that. Folks that are willing to join us virtually because they can do so from their couch and not have to worry about trying to make the extensive travel plans that would be necessary for them to come to Chattanooga.
And tell us a little more about some of these authors.
Well, so we've got a wide range of authors. And of course, I'm going to say this more than once, Ray. I'm going to push people to yahoofest.org because every author is linked there. But we've got everything from local Tennesseans, in fact, folks from right here in Chattanooga, all the way to, like I said, folks from California, Chicago, New York. The genres run anywhere from sci-fi and fantasy to historical fiction to contemporary romance. We've got a little bit of something for everybody.
What have you been hearing from some of these authors? What have you been hearing from the people that you usually talk to who are into this literature? about what they've been reading these past few months, which seem a lot longer than the past few months.
Right. I don't know about Linda, but for me, the last few months have seemed like the last few years at this point. What I'm hearing from the authors is, one, that they're really excited that we're moving forward with a virtual event, that folks feel trapped at home. And so this is something they can get excited about and participate in, but can do so safely, without concern for pandemic cautions. But I think also we're hearing excitement from our attendees, because we've got folks from all over the country that are registering who couldn't attend otherwise. And so I think even in subsequent years, Ray, when we hold the festival, we'll still probably broadcast it, because it's going to allow for a much wider exposure for the authors.
And Linda, tell us more about how Southern Lit Alliance is involved in all this.
The whole idea about Young Adult Genre Festival came out of our strategic planning several years ago, and Joel Henderson has been on our board for a while and offered to have Chat State be involved, and so they had just been awesome to partner and sponsor and support, and a lot of their staff organized getting the authors in. So it's been a great support for us in a way that we can reach some teens and younger generation, and all of us working together encourage that generation to read and get involved in literature.
And not only is this an opportunity for these authors to showcase their work, it is to talk about writing. It's about sharing the craft.
For sure. And we're really excited this year. A piece that's kind of been missing in previous years was getting our panels connected with local students. And this year we've got a partnership with Hamilton County Schools, who've just been remarkable to work with us in our planning. Even though they, like everyone else, are in crisis mode right now, they're still working really hard to get this panel information in the hands of their students so that they can attend these sessions virtually. And Ray, as you say, that's exactly what the panels are about, the craft of writing. So is it writing nonfiction? Is it writing fiction? Is it writing sci-fi? Is it how to create better characters, how to make a realistic setting and world building, all those things? We've got panels on all those things.
And these students have certainly lived and are living a lot of experiences these past few months that seem more like the past few years. And that's where writing, where good writing, where great writing can spring from.
For me, I read oftentimes to find an escape, and I can't think of a time in recent history where I'm more interested in escaping than it is, you know, in the last several months when we've all been stuck in quarantine. So this chance to escape, this chance to see their own stories in print, that's another aspect of what we try to do, is to make sure we have a really diverse group of authors so that each attendee can see his or her own story reflected on the page.
And where can people go online for more information and to participate?
You can go to www.yahoofest.org for a list of all the authors, the panels, and our sponsors that are helping us with the event. For information about Southern Lit Alliance, you can go to southernlitalliance.org and see about our other programs about literature and writing.
All right. Linda, Joel, thanks so much.
Thank you, Ray. Thank you.
You're listening to Scenic Roots. More in a moment.
This is Scenic Roots. This afternoon on Talking Writing, our guest is poet, teacher, and most recently graduate student, Cynthia Robinson Young. Cynthia is an adjunct professor of special education at Covenant College, but she's spending much of her time at the moment working on her first novel, which she hopes to complete by sometime in the spring. This is the second part of our conversation. The first part was on Scenic Roots the week before last. It's on the radio station website if you missed it. We began with Cynthia reading a poem she hasn't yet published.
Now you see me. I was raised to be invisible, to hide from the boogeyman, to not go with strange men, even if they were called uncle. To walk away from a lover after the first slap, when he said, "Baby, I didn't mean it, but you made me do it." But I was also raised to be a good daughter, to not take up too much air, to do what I was told without looking back. And so I sat in that barber's chair for a facial. And I, hungry for perfection, let him put his hands on my teenage face, covered with perceived imperfections, all distorted in the bathroom mirror. But I didn't want his hands to roam down to my chest, barely budding. Good thing I was raised with black girl magic, with the power to leave that chair, to run from the boogeyman, to be strong enough to tell, to raise my voice, to scream.
While I wasn't raised to be invisible, the rest of it resonates. I know exactly what you mean. I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah. Mm.
It's a very disturbing feeling when you're small, surrounded by adults, and you're not sure if they can be trusted.
Right, right.
Did you have that experience very often?
Well, I feel like there's a lot of truth in this poem, because I feel like as children, especially in, you know, our home, we're like, you're supposed to be seen and not heard, and, you know, you don't interrupt adult conversations, and, you know, you just stay as invisible as you can. And then just the whole thing about if you're not invisible, bad things can actually happen to you, you know.
It's funny you say that, because that's exactly the household I grew up in. My grandfather, especially my mother's father, he and my grandmother spent a lot of time with us in the house when we were children, because my mother was working, and so they'd come and take care of us during the holidays. And he was very Victorian, and that was absolutely his philosophy. Why am I hearing from these children? What have they got to tell me? You know, children were meant to be seen and not heard. I can't tell you how many times I've heard that one. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
Another of your poems that resonated, I think, probably as much as anything because of the conversations we've had before, because you didn't grow up in the South, I don't think, did you?
No.
So your poem, Jericho Revisited, the whole time I was reading it, it kept flashing on conversations we've had about why you came back here and how you felt about it when you did come back here.
Yeah. That was another poem that when it got workshopped, you know, with my white poet friends, they weren't sure, especially what was happening. Like, wait, what? But I love this poem, and I just believed in it. And then that got accepted by an African-American journal who, you know, they read it and they got it right away, you know.
Jericho Revisited. 1. Running away through oak and pine, my ancestors' nightmares continue in my dreams. And as dreams go, I am catapulting through time and space. I am in Newark with my father, circa 1959, surrendered, safe. Then suddenly in the New South, black landscaped again. Us, all moneyed up now. I am migrating back to what was once feared, returning because I want safety in the place that was never safe. We want the ghosts of bygone days purged. The land my great-grandparents slavishly worked appears peaceful. Still, I hesitate at the border. This southern soil has called me back for retribution, for reparation, for all that was promised. 2. We want to partake freely with southern richness, like cold buttermilk and hot cornbread. We stand in our tribes, waiting for our inheritance. Our ancestors have led us back to their promised land. It has already been surveyed by the first to return. They saw the monuments, the statues, like giants commemorating our enslavers, celebrating their effort to hold us down. We feared we might once again wear the mask, but we are blended and bonded now. We are all colors of peach and tan and brown and black, and we don't hate ourselves or each other for it. See us marching around that southern wall. Hear us playing our saxophones and trumpets, beating our snare and conga drums. Watch us dance our dances, the cakewalk juba and bop, Charleston camel walk and chicken step.
We're coming back to the South, and we want to change it. We want to get back to what it should have been.
The Southern soil has called me back for retribution, for reparation, for all that was promised.
Yeah.
Such a fractured history.
But, you know, I love it. Yeah, I love the South.
I know. You can. Yeah. That's apparent. The next verse, we want to partake freely from Southern richness, like cold buttermilk and hot cornbread. We stand in our tribes waiting for our inheritance. Our ancestors have led us back to their promised land. So this was your land in as much as your family.
Like
generations.
Obama says, we built it. Yeah, so many things we built but didn't get to, and that wealth that came from all the work that African Americans slaves did.
How would you feel if you built a house and somebody told you you couldn't live in it?
Right. And that basically was our lives.
Right. And then there's the Walnut Street Bridge.
The Walnut Street Walking Bridge. Chattanooga, Tennessee. They thought in the year of 2010, they could close the bridge and recreate it, paint it hate blue to keep its evil past away, dedicated to wash away its sins. But the generations of Black Chattanoogans will not forget what happened on the night of March 19th in 1906. And the elders still say it is haunted, still say that on foggy nights, they can see Ed Johnson hanging from the noose he wore for the crime he bore, the violation of a white woman. The payment? A convenient Black man. A prisoner of mob law, he was noosed at the jail and dragged to the bridge. Now, on stormy nights, when the river is restless, the elders say they can hear the splash of his blood cutting water. And on the 4th of July, amid the fireworks celebrating freedom, they hear the 55 gunshots for giving the murderous mob last words choked out, a benediction echoing across all these years. God bless you all. I am an innocent man. If all that is needed to be my judge, jury, and executioner is to be a different color, to speak a different language, to have different ideas, to believe in a God you cannot see, then I could be a gory decoration, a mob left abased and hanging from a poplar tree, hidden in a forest, or dangling from a cursed bridge in the middle of a city, for even the children to see. I could be Ed Johnson.
What's going on with that statue they're supposed to be putting up? I thought that was supposed to be up already.
Well, I know they're working on it because for Juneteenth, they had a, a march across the Walnut Street Bridge. And I took my daughter and my son with me and to participate in that. And we had to congregate on one side of the bridge because they said the other side of the bridge was being worked on with the memorial for Ed Johnson. So I said, oh, good, they're working on it at least. So probably the COVID didn't help, you know, it go any faster. But the way I understand it, they are still working on it. Yeah, I haven't been down there since whenever on that side. I haven't really gone downtown. I'm mostly staying home because of COVID.
Talk about the boogeyman.
The boogeyman, yes. You can't see him, but everyone's supposed to be terrified.
Actually, you know, thinking about it, Cynthia, and looking at your poetry again, it would seem to fall into two streams, really. There's those that are immediately personal, even though they're universal, like Cornered, for instance.
Cornered. I have stood on corners, shaking with fear and cold, waiting with my sister on a northeastern November night, neon blinking Budweiser in a ghoulish light on our young black faces. My sister wasn't old enough to protect herself, so how could she protect me? The boys who could be men were coming toward us. The street lamp lit up the mischief in their eyes, and I wish the light would hypnotize them and hold them at that halo until our mother could come out of the bar to rescue us. But the bar windows were tinted dark. No one is meant to see through them. Dark enough to protect the ones inside who start their drinking early in the day and stop early in the next. Our mother did not do that. She was not like that. She was the mother who says, I'll only be a minute. Just wait right here in the corner, by the door. You'll be safe. I'll be right back out. We had to believe her. She was our mother. We had no choice. The men who could be boys were saying things our mother would never allow her daughters to hear. She would have shut them up. She would have washed their mouths out.
I'm not sure there are many people, sadly, who haven't had something akin to that experience at some point in their lives, where they've been on the street and usually boys or young men in a group coming the other way feel threatening. I certainly can relate to that. I grew up in London, as I said, in the 60s, and there were young people basically divided into skinheads and people who weren't skinheads.
Right.
And if your hair was long, so much the worse, because you're almost certainly going to be a target. So I know how that feels. I don't know how it feels to you, but I know how it felt to me.
Mm.
So there's that, a poem like that, or, you know, about your mum naming you after the moon. It's interesting, really, I guess, as with everything in life, it's kind of on a spectrum, because not just to have the bluest eye could be read either way. It's very personal, and yet at the same time, for a African-American person, that seems to be pretty universal.
I think it's always been an issue that because of what we've gone through, that the lighter of the skin, the more accessible.
But that would seem to be, you know, because the power structure was largely white. So the closer you resemble the power structure, the more likely it is that you're going to be unmolested and gain entree.
Right. So it would seem anywhere where there was colonialism, that should maybe be the case, but I don't know.
But you have been looking at Nigerian writers, I think, right? Does anybody talk much about that in their work that you've seen?
Not the books that I'm reading are more. Actually, they're centered more around wars, Nigerian wars, and the family structure there. And what I've loved about it, especially this one book that I'm reading right now called The Fisherman, it really deals a lot with the African and Nigerian family and culture. And I'm like, this is just like African American culture. So it's interesting how much of our DNA has just, you know, stayed with us, that we still even raise our children have those same values, you know, that African parents have. You know, we haven't lost that. We still are one in many areas, even though we've had different experiences.
That's interesting. Is that a result of received wisdom? Is that the kind of, you know, advice that you got from your parents and your grandparents?
Yeah, I wonder. I mean, I wonder if it just got passed down, you know, and to the point that we haven't been conscious of it, but it's been a subconscious passing down of values and just how we look at our family, how we look at our children, you know, what kind of value do we place on community? Things like that.
Yeah. That makes that whole notion of African American that much more resonant, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Why did you start looking at Nigerian writers?
Because so you know this because of migration, but I've been like really trying to get into the family history, and so, you know, having my DNA done, and Ancestry.com is saying that I am 43% Nigerian, as far as, you know, the bloodline. So I'm like, well, I should see what's going on, you know, since, you know, it's that high a percentage. So then I just started, you know, reading more Nigerian history and culture, especially the fiction, and just loving it. Oh my goodness. Just loving just the beauty of the language, the proverbs and folk tales that are just embedded into the culture along with Christianity. It's really fascinating. So, yeah. That's how it came about. I'm really enjoying learning more about it. And I have my son, my youngest son has a Nigerian middle name. And so when he's around other Nigerians at college, they get really excited. They say, oh, you have a Nigerian name. And so he has friends that are Nigerian too. So it's fun. I wish I knew more, but, you know, I'm working on it.
I understand. As I say, I've lived in America almost exactly 50 years. Couple of years shy of it at the moment. There are so many subtle differences between British and American culture. And even after 50 years, there's still this sense that even if it's unfamiliar, it's familiar.
Right.
I think perhaps the same is true for you.
Yeah. Definitely.
That's an interesting kind of mystical thing about who we really are, you know?
Yeah. So this book, The Fisherman,
it centers around four brothers, and they remind me so much of my sons and how they would relate to each other. And so that's another thing that resonated with me and why I just really have enjoyed that book in particular. Just how, you know, how that family's trying to raise these sons and the values they put in them are the values that I tried to instill in my sons. And, you know, I don't think I've been as successful as they were, but because it's a fiction, they weren't that successful either. But, yeah. Oh, my goodness.
Why did you decide to write a novel?
Well, as I said, I heard that story from my my aunt. And so I've been thinking about it and thinking about it, like, you know. And then when my, you know, other aunt said it wasn't true, and I'm like, well, what if it was, you know? And it's just been fun, you know, trying to figure out how to integrate what I know about my family, you know, what I know about Nigerian culture, what I know about the South. I'm trying to integrate all of that. And then I needed a thesis. So I found my novel thesis. So
and
that's why I'm doing it.
The novel was a better form to tell that story than a poem.
Yeah. Well, yeah, what happened at UTC is that they kind of phased out the poetry department, I don't know what you call it. Well, the poetry concentration when I got there. And so I felt like I could get more help from the fiction professors that were there. So that's why I decided to go that route. And they have been helpful, so, yeah.
Has having written so much poetry helped you at all in writing fiction?
I was thinking about that. Because, you know, with this COVID, for some reason, for the first time in my life, it started giving me writer's block. I think I'm just stressed out from, you know, what is, you know, not just the COVID, but everything is like, what is going to happen next? So, you know, the big things being the Black Lives Matter, the COVID, the elections, and whatever else is going to happen when we wake up tomorrow that we can't handle, you know, and it's just like, I can't write. All I can do is read. So, but I've been wanting to write because when the COVID started, I wrote every day in April and came up with some really good work because I was really feeling things. But now I've almost become numb, I feel like. And so hopefully I'm reading because that's one thing you do when you can't write, you just gather information by observing the world. And so I'm reading and I'm walking. And I'm hoping that all that creative whatever is coming together. And when I sit down to write the novel and to hopefully write more poetry, it'll be there ready. Because right now I got nothing.
I guess it's the most frustrating thing about any creative endeavor is as much as we like to think we can control it, we really can't.
No,
it's either there or it's not. And if it's not there, there's a reason it's not there. And it's not that it's not there.
Right, I mean, there's fights, you know, there's a lot of, you know, disagreement about that. Some people say you still have to sit down and put something on paper. And then some people say, you know, this might be the time of gathering. Mm. So I feel like I, you know, land on the ladder. That maybe there's a time to gather in your body and your, you know, subconscious what you want to write about instead of forcing something to come out that's stupid.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. I'm not sure if completely thought this through, but it strikes me that it's the same in anything in nature, whether it's our bodies or the earth. Nothing produces constantly. There has to be fallow times in order for there to be productive times.
Oh, yeah.
She named me after the moon. My mother named me after a moon goddess, for she hoped I would at least light my own path, not trip over too much of life's debris, and certainly not trip others. When I told my family what I saw the day the clouds fell down and emptied the sky, soft pillows blanketing 1959 Plymouths and Cadillacs, until nothing was left except baby blue above, and everyone dismissed it as fog, my mother never doubted the visions I could see. I was her daughter, child of the moon, who chose not to read messages unless lit by starlight. My mother named me after a moon goddess who was born on a mountain with her twin brother. They say, if you are born alone and left-handed, you had a twin, a ghost sibling who got lost. I am left-handed, and I've always known someone was missing. When the clouds fell from the sky on the morning of that summer day, I know my twin would have believed me because he would have been right beside me, peering up into that cloudless baby blue, touching the soft pillows that were like the fog on Lookout Mountain, but too heavy even to hold, my twin and I, loony together. When the yellow moon is round and confident, we still converse, our words starlit. I feel the ghost, and he sees them. He brings me their stories, and I sing him their songs. He has seen what Martin Luther King dreamed. His soul has already taken that look back and knows how we got over.
Cynthia Robinson Young with the one and only Richard Wenham. You're listening to Scenic Roots on WUTC. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Roots. We come to you from WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Email us at scenicroots423@gmail.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at scenicroots423. Listen to us online anytime at WUTC.org and the WUTC app. For Richard Wenham and the rest of our team, join us again next time for Scenic Roots.